Welcome back to the story of Esther. We're in chapter 2 today as we all sit quietly to hear Grandpa tell the story at Purim. Okay, so most of us are quiet. I get in trouble sometimes. And our story left off with an edict. Queen Vashti is banished, and every man should be ruler over his own household. Now, historians tell us that ancient Persia followed a patriarchal paradigm. Yet within that patriarchy, women had more rights and responsibilities than almost any other ancient civilization, owned land, conducted business, even got equal pay. Sadly, Persian women would lose those rights a millennium later. Yet here in 480 BC, the women have many rights, and their social ranking is hierarchical, with the queen near the top. But the patriarchy has flexed its muscle, and the role of queen is now vacant. What happens next? Listen in as Grandpa begins chapter 2. Later, when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, "Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful young women into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Well, girl power fans, this just got worse. A search for beautiful young virgins and a contest to please the king? I guess you could romanticize it. A trip to the palace, lavish beauty treatments, a shot at being queen. After all, this is the world, the way it is. Now, at Purim, everyone reads verse 5 together. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin, named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish. I love this intro. There was a Jew. Still no sign of God, but one of God's people just showed up. Mordecai. A little reminder here. Introducing Mordecai as a Jew is not the Bible signal that he's the good guy. Neither does it make him the bad guy. It is simply a reminder that God has made a covenant with his people, through good or bad. The exile is testimony to that. And look at his lineage. He's a descendant of Kish the Benjamite. That's the father of King Saul. If it's the same Kish, then Mordecai has royal blood, fallen royal blood. And verse 6 reminds us again of fallen kings with a reference to the exile of wicked King Jehoiachin. Will Mordecai do better than his forebears? Verse 7. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up, because she had neither father nor mother. And so we arrive at our hero, an orphan girl, now a young woman with two different names. Her Hebrew name, Hadassah, means myrtle, a small tree with beautiful star-shaped flowers. But she is known by her Persian name, Esther. It means star, perhaps a connection to the myrtle. But to the Persian ear, it sounds closer to the goddess Ishtar. Many of us know the complexities of forming identity with two different names in two different cultures. By the way, Mordecai's name could easily be taken as a Persian name revering the god Marduk. These two Jews fit in rather well in Persia. Interesting note, however, if you listen to Esther's Persian name with Hebrew ears, it almost sounds like the word Hester, which means hidden. In English, it would be like a girl named Iden. You can't help but wonder if there's more to this girl's name and this girl. Back in verse 7, this young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Pause there. Esther is beautiful. Says so right there in the Bible. Her figure is lovely. Now, what I find interesting here is what we each read into that, and how some of us can't see beyond it. Some see beauty with eyes of appreciation, others desire, and others still envy. many make assumptions of entitlement or unfair advantage. More opportunistic eyes will try to exploit beauty. A woman's beauty is a powerful force. What are we to make of Esther's loveliness? The text doesn't say. We do know, back in verse 7, that Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. So Mordecai puts us all to shame. He looks at Esther with eyes of compassion, the eyes of a father to the fatherless. And what a statement. He took her as his own daughter. Verse 8. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many young women were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Haggai. Esther also was taken. Don't miss the contrast and the repetition of taken. Mordecai saw a beautiful young girl, had compassion, and took responsibility for her, took care of her. The king's palace saw her beauty, had desire, and took her. They each saw beauty, but with different eyes and to different ends. Yet for Esther, the word taken only underscores that all of this is out of her control. Esther is in the harem now, and she quickly wins the favor of Haggai, the eunuch in charge. And in verse 9, he moved her and her attendants into the best place in the harem. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Clearly, Mordecai knows it's dangerous to be a Jew in the Persian Empire. But this has to be tough for Esther, to form identity while hiding her roots. Was she wrong to hide them? Was Mordecai wrong? The text doesn't say, but it does say that every day he walked back and forth near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now that's real concern. And it goes on for a while. 12 months go by while Esther gets beauty treatments. 12 months. That's some serious beauty obsession. Oils, perfumes, cosmetics. Full Persian beauty immersion. And verse 13 tells us how a young woman would go to the king. She takes what she wants from the harem. In the evening, she would cross the courtyard to the king's palace, and in the morning, return to another part of the harem. The language is so matter of fact, it's almost painful to read. The author is kind to spare us the details, but there's no secret what's happening here. Each young woman is returned to another part of the harem, no longer with the virgins. She's a concubine now. And in verse 14, she would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. And that's it. Now, the king's concubines were high on the social ladder, but no kids, no husband, and no real say in the matter. Yet still, the writer offers us no sense of right or wrong here. Just the way it is. Then in verse 15, Esther's turn arrives. Funny that the writer reminds us here that she was adopted and even gives us her dad's name now. A little reminder that under the cosmetics, she is still that Jewish girl. Esther goes, takes only what the king's eunuch tells her to take, and it says, Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. In verse 17, now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. She did it. Esther is queen. And just look how happy the king is. In verse 18, he gives a great banquet, Esther's banquet, and he wants all his nobles to celebrate. He wants everyone to celebrate. He proclaims a holiday for the whole empire, and he gets very generous with the gifts. Is it a happy ending? More like an intriguing beginning. The real story is yet to come, and it starts with a little addendum to chapter 2. First, we learn that Esther continues to follow cousin Mordecai's instructions, though communication is more difficult. Mordecai works at the king's gate and delivers messages when he can. He tells Esther to keep her family background a secret. But is that right? Should she conceal her identity, her people, her covenant with God? Yet all of that is so distant now. This is the world, the way it is. And God's name still isn't so much as mentioned. Where are you, Lord? One bit of intrigue closes the chapter. Two of the king's officers conspire to assassinate King Xerxes. And in verse 22, but Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. So Mordecai saves the king. The two conspirators are impaled. Yuck. And it's all recorded in the king's books. What will come of those books? Read Esther 2, and we'll find out soon.
Join us next time as we continue the journey, one chapter at a time. And remember, faith comes by hearing, and hearing through the word.